All right.
What is it?
It is...
Because I can't hear it.
It's a band. Just pretend it's fading out. All right. I watched a documentary on No Wave Cinema yesterday, and they had... I realized that I have some No Wave classics, but I definitely have not explored the No Wave archives completely.
Do you want to explain what No Wave is?
It's people playing music who can't play music.
I thought that was punk rock.
No, well, No Wave was more and that song isn't actually very no wavy. You know, it's I think it's a little more poppy than your typical no wave.
Seriously though? I mean, that's no wave, is that how no wavers would describe themselves?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, like,
well, why is that different than punk rock?
Well, like, so if you think of like early Lydia Lunch stuff or like Teenage Jesus and the Jerks, where it's like one drum like going crack, 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 and then the guitars are kind of going clank, 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 clank. It's kind of like the...
That sounds like capoeira music.
Right, no, but it's like even more noisy than your typical post-punk, British post-punk kind of stuff.
It sounds like something I would like because it's,
you would like
sounds
it.
Very... Yeah. Yeah, I mean, every time No Wave, there's some No Wave song playing, I always go, ooh, what's this? You know, yeah. I like the more basic hypnotic drum, but, you know, not
right.
Hip,
it's
not
much
shoegazer,
more primitive and less... Yeah. Like that song that I just played is...
Which
it's
I
got
didn't
too
hear.
Many irregular chords. Like, it's somebody actually playing chords properly. But it's still got that primitive. It's still got elements of no wave. But so I guess that's why I wasn't aware of it before. But anyways, that music was in the documentary.
When was the time frame?
Late 70s, early 80s.
So same as punk. So did the no wavers like the punk rockers? Or?
It's after punk. Well, original punk, I guess maybe you would call it, like the New York scene. You know, that first new wave, right. Punk wave in New York, and then you had your no wave after that, which was the people who were much... It was much more... I don't know. I don't know how to explain it, but I could go through and find some other stuff. I played a song for you once by Mars or DNA or something like that, and you really liked it. I knew you would like it. So I'll get you the No Wave.
Maybe I'll start a No Wave band.
Right, exactly. Yeah, the No Wave New York compilation. I tried to start a No Wave band with some people, like on a whim, and it didn't work out.
Oh, maybe I'll have to find a guitarist to start a No Wave band with.
That's the thing. It was a funny quote. It's like nobody wanted to be good at what they were. It wasn't cool to be good at something. So like John Lurie was saying, he didn't tell people he played the saxophone because... That was not cool.
Right.
So he started making films because he had never made films before. So he became a filmmaker, and then all the painters. So like Jean-Michel Basquiat, right? He was in a band. He was a painter, but it was all kind of all mixed up. Vincent Gallo was part of that scene too. Was in a band, was an actor, was a painter.
Yeah.
As a filmmaker,
so you
an actor. Say actor?
Yeah, and so right. So all this is to sort of emphasize what you don't know how to do and do that instead, because there's more purity in it.
I think it was just because, you know, because honestly, this is the famous moment I had with a friend of mine in high school at the record store, where it was like I had heard a Clash song, and I was looking at London Calling. And I was like, I think I'm going to buy this because I loved like 50s rock and roll and everything like that. And he said, oh, are you sure that's punk rock? And I said, well, I heard it and it just sounded like rock and roll to me.
But that's,
you know, and that was the thing.
That's a gateway record. You're going to start doing drugs.
Exactly. It was kind of like, you know, I mean, it was a wonderful movement and everything like that. But that kind of classic punk rock is not that revolutionary in terms of music. I mean, in terms of cultural impact, right? Going back to the basics, right?
Yeah.
But it is a very retro movement, right? It's like, oh, let's embrace, you know, simple rock and roll, right? And so in a way, and so that's what's appealing about the new wave thing. I think it was that, oh yeah, well, you know what? That's not really that, you know, it's still kind of classic rock kind of, or rock and roll stuff. You know, you think about Patti Smith and it's like, there's like a punk rock element to it, but there's a lot of obvious, you know, obvious direct, you know, garage rock and roll references.
It does sound garage rocky.
Because the man who kind of created the garage rock fan scene, you know, was her guitar player. So it's mm-hmm. it's kind of like that. There's a retro element to that. Whereas, yeah, I think the no wave scene was kind of more like in, you know, like treating your instrument as a, you know, in an abstract way, right? Rather than treating it in a traditional musical way. Like you would like abstract art, right? You're making chunks of sound rather than musical phrases, of which none of which that song that I just played, you know, that song is more kind of like a pop punk no wavy somewhat kind of combo, which I guess is why I liked it.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if it's just the drum beat. You know, oh, that's no wave. Listen to the drum beat.
I like the chords too. Just the guitar. Right.
And dun, 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 and you can tell they're like probably just strumming down the whole time. They're
yeah. So like the feelies are not no wave, but there's elements of that. You could say, oh, there's a connection between like early feely. Well, actually, just a lot of feely stuff in that too. You know, the kind of guitar, very basic. Getting to.
Sound, you listen to Sound Opinions. This portion of Radio Zero brought to you by Sound Opinions. And who did you see in the movie that you were watching last night?
So Jet. I saw Jet in the movie. So our manager in the
Jet,
the 90s, Mel, who I think is now going by Michael again, but who was known as Jet in the 70s, is in Fingered with Lydia Lunch. And so they started talking about this film Fingered, and I was like, I've seen that. We have that. Why, you know, where do we get that? And then all of a sudden they show a clip of Mel, you know, saying to Lydia Lunch, hey, baby, how much? And then she starts screaming at him. And it was like, oh, okay. Yeah, Mel gave that to us because it was his big movie moment in one of the most notorious no wave. Or no, that's actually, what was that called? Cinema. I can't even remember. I just watched the movie last night. I wasn't even aware of that movement, Cinema Transgression or something like that. It was like this movement within the no wave scene and film scene. So, but it was a cool movie, you know, like, you know, you had your Steve Buscemi in there and your,
yeah, you were freaked out that Steve Buscemi actually looked nice. You said.
Yeah, it's weird. Like the 20-year-old nice Steve Buscemi is not as disturbing. You would expect him to just look like a smoother version of a scarecrow, but he's almost unrecognizable. And then just seeing that Jim Jarmusch too, and seeing Stranger Than Paradise, clips from Stranger Than Paradise, and Richard Edson, like just watching him and the weird things he does with his faces. It's like, why is that man not our Marlon Brando, our generation's Marlon Brando? It's like, how come, like even the way, like I'm thinking of in Ferris Bueller's Day Off when Richard Edson walks up, you know, and he's like doing those things with his eyebrows, you know, saying he'll take care of the car, and he's just doing these weird things with his
alive?
Eyes. Yeah, I think he's still alive. And it's just like, wow. I mean, you realize that some of that is just the way he is, I think. I don't think that's acting, you know? And it's like, I'm going to have to find some recent movies. I feel like I've seen Richard Edson recently, but anyways, it made me miss, it made me want to see Stranger Than Paradise again. And that was amazing too. Actually thinking about that, I'm sorry, but they were talking about how everything kind of changed with that. Smithereens, that movie, it's the woman who did Desperately Seeking Susan. So that was the movie that kind of pushed her to the mainstream, and then Stranger Than Paradise kind of burst, got into the mainstream. And they were talking about that switch where like people were playing, you know, or Wild Style, that movie Wild Style about hip hop, you know, how that was the second most popular movie in New York City after Terms of Endearment the week it came out.
Wow.
You know, it was like when things switched over. But the fact that we went to see Stranger Than Paradise in the co-ed theater in Champaign in 1984 or whatever it was, that it was playing in a movie theater, And that's to me. So this is, I always go back to this.
That like, is kind of weird. Yeah.
It was an amazing experience. Yeah. Like being able to see a movie like that, that had totally alien kind of tempo. You know, we had seen art movie, you know, they had the art
Right. Shows. But this was at the actual,
the actual movie college theater. It was college theater, but it was the chain, you know, it was the place that had, I remember the guys we knew who worked at that theater saying they were getting tired of Dances with Wolves because it had been playing for a year and a half. You know, it was the theater that, I mean, they played mainstream movies. Just imagine that too. At some point, a movie could play for like a year in a theater. But just how revolutionary was that you could walk into a mainstream movie theater and see a film that strange. And then that was when I went into a mainstream theater and saw Rushmore, like whatever it was, 10 or 15 years later. That was why I got so angry, was because I was going to see an independent film. And I was like, you know what? In the past, it was exciting to see an independent film in a mainstream theater because you felt like things were changing or there was, you know, a change in the culture. Whereas to me, what happened with Rushmore, which I love, it's a great movie, but it was like, you know what? Now the independent films are like just good mainstream films. Because to me, Rushmore is not a cutting edge film. It's a great film by a great director. But, you know, it would be as if you saw a Martin Scorsese film in the theaters in the 70s. It was like, oh, okay, this is a great film, but it's not, you know, avant-garde or, or alternative or indie cinema. It's just a good movie. And it's like, oh, it's great to see a good movie. And so that's what disappointed me too, is just kind of this idea. It doesn't exist anymore where you can, and it's on the web, I guess. It's all just moved to the web, but there those moments don't exist anymore, I feel like. Or I'm just old, right?
There's a you know, I mean, there's something very different about watching something on the web too, you know, because it's not, you're not sitting in a theater with a bunch of people. We were talking about this just earlier, probably last week too. But if you do watch Stranger Than Paradise, I'd like to see it again too, because I was very young. I feel very like I was very young when I saw that, like, you know, in understanding pace of cinema.
Well, you know what was great about that movie too is I think it's like a generational thing. It's like, so I was a movie fan. I'd watch, you know, I'd see Apocalypse Now and Blade Runner and, you know, Raging Bull or Taxi Driver, but that was all, you know, 60s generation guys. And then when you saw Stranger Than Paradise, it was like, oh, okay, this is our cinema.
Somebody our age is,
it's like, I can appreciate 60s and 70s great filmmakers, but it was like, that was not our generation. And so that was what was amazing about it. Just at the time, it was like, oh, okay, this is our generation's, you know, film.
And yes, I'd like to see that again too.
And then I guess what happened was, is when I saw Rushmore, it was like the next generation is, oh, okay, independent film is for you to get, to become a mainstream filmmaker. It's a farm team, right? It's no longer a lifetime kind of occupation. You know, independent filmmaking is just a stepping stone. All right. Well,
thank you for listening.
What do you want to talk about? You talk about something. Let's do a Rose topic. Because my topics, I just sit here and rant.
No, I love your
without
topics.
Any, no, I don't without have any interaction. I just,
somebody contacted me and asked me about virtual reality. And whether or not they wanted
could you
me
help
to
me? I'm lost inside of it.
Virtual reality. Now, you know, I have to email her back too. But it's a student is doing a report on it, and I feel really, you know, and then she, like, the next email was, oh, I see you don't work at U of I anymore. And I was like, yeah, so can I get out of this? You know, and I don't understand why I don't just, I'm like, yeah, I don't do that anymore. See you later. Bye. But
because you're an educator and you want to help give people information.
Yeah, I don't know if I really want to talk about virtual reality, though. I mean, and I don't know. I mean, I'm like a naysayer in it. And I was even when I was working in it, you know? I mean, it was like, and I think I wrote to her, you know, her teacher says it's obsolete, and she's arguing that it isn't. And I mean,
they're probably both right. So the original way of thinking about it is obsolete.
Right. And it's like artificial intelligence, you know, was like, you know, there was a great promise back in the, I don't know when, you know, oh my God, there's going to be artificial intelligence. And then, you know, you had all the, you know, the movies that you like to talk about where the computer's taking over, you know, cause it's self-aware. And then you know, the algorithms for creating an artificial intelligence were, you know, either like brute force, you know, where you put everything, you know, you have these giant databases, giant memories, you know, filled with every possible option, and then you traverse them, right? Or you build, you build knowledge in sort of a more linear vectorial way, And all, like, you know, I took the Lisp class and everything like that, I remember. But I remember, you know, the promise of artificial intelligence back when we were in college, you know, in the late 80s, was, you know, that there was nothing going to happen for, you know, many, many years. And now there are artificial intelligences, right? I mean, that's what I've said to this girl. You know, there are programs that learn, you know, and there are 3D movies, right? Virtual reality movies.
Yeah, somebody showed a website in one of my classes the other day, and it was all about this community in Zurich or something, like this neighborhood. And all the navigation is, it kind of looks like Street View. So they've animated the website so that you wander through this neighborhood and you can go into the stores, and then you can learn about each store in this neighborhood and the school.
I was going to say, that sounds like augmented reality.
Yeah,
no,
augmented
you're right.
Reality.
No, it's so, virtual yeah. reality. If you're right. doing it, if you're doing it from the website.
But even augmented reality, it's yeah. just, you can't predict. It's so if you're doing predictive work, it's not it is going to be obsolete, right?
Yeah.
But if you do the work and then it you know, the culture or the technology catches up and then you can implement some of it in different ways. It's kind of like, you know, like if you had asked me 10 years ago, you know, are people really going to navigate the web in a visual kind of, you know, simulation, you know, the Neuromancer or whatever it is, Johnny Mnemonic kind of way, I'd say no, you know, that's not what it's going to be like. And now I'm like, oh yeah, it is going to be like that. Why not?
Right.
And it's not necessarily going to be like that on a computer screen. It's going to be like, you're going to be walking around the real world and the technology, the data, I mean, is going to be projected on the real world, right?
Right, right.
And so...
So yeah, you know, the computer's not going to take over the world and do your job for you or whatever. But I'm on the internet and I'm getting free people ads, and that's because something, you know, knows that I like free people, and if I start buying the wrong kind of vitamins and hand sanitizer, then Target's going to know I'm pregnant and start sending me stuff, right? I mean,
I
so
love
that's
that,
that's sort of an artificial intelligence sort of thing, right? I mean,
yeah.
Bots climb the web and, you know, cruise the web and learn more information about you. So,
but is that artificial intelligence, or is that like more like expert? What do they call it? They started talking about
expert
systems.
Yeah, I don't know. But I mean, but so
it's not like a human intelligence, right?
Right. But it falls out. It's the same sort of idea, right? So you know, just saying, oh yeah, virtual reality is obsolete. It's not obsolete because, you know, my kids go to see 3D movies all the time. You know, where they're putting on all right. So what's obsolete about virtual reality? Let's think about what virtual reality is. It's somebody walking, you know, going to a special place that costs, you know, $20,000 with screens on it, right? And then having to put on some very expensive glasses, or maybe $20 glasses.
And then playing paintball.
Right.
Virtual paintball.
Right, right. That's virtual reality. And maybe they're playing with somebody else who's connected to them with the internet too, you know, whatever they used to be connected
Tron.
With.
Tron.
You know.
There's lots of Tron going on.
Lots
Probably.
Of Tron going on, and they're connected, you know, to somebody in Florida because Disney World is there, you know, it's, they've got money, right? So, mm-hmm. so, and that's, you know, and somewhere else they're connected to also. So that's virtual reality. Wow, that's obsolete. Well, which part of that is obsolete?
Yeah, it's the hardware, right?
Is it the visiting, the having to go, like nobody wants to go to one place. Like
yeah.
They're not going to go to a movie theater to, you know, do this singular experience of virtual reality, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, all right, so is that obsolete, or is the donning of goggles obsolete? You know, like nobody's, the other critique of virtual reality is, oh, nobody's going to want to put, you know, glasses on. They're heavy on your head. You're not going to want to walk around with glasses on and do whatever it is that you're doing. But people are going to the movie theaters and using those glasses. So that's not really obsolete either. I mean, it is, it's more enjoyable for our kids to watch a 3D movie than it is to watch not a 3D movie. I mean, I don't mind it either. I get a headache afterwards, but
yeah, I don't think a 3D movie is a good example though, because it is it's potentially just a fad again, and it's inefficient. What you're saying? It's an inefficient, kind of antiquated experience.
You really think it's a fad? I don't think it's a fad.
It may not be a fad, but it's an antiquated experience. Going to a what you were just saying, going to a specialized location to experience something.
But people, no, that's not obsolete either, because people are still going to be going to movie theaters for a long time.
Right, but it's not going to be part of everyday life, whereas 100 years ago, or let me do my math, yeah, 100 years ago, or no, let's say 75 years ago, that was an everyday part of life. People would go to the movie theater daily or once a week. You know, it was integrated into their lives. They'd listen to the radio every day, but they'd go to the theater once a week, you know.
I think to solve this problem, there has to be a definition of what virtual reality is. And then if you want to only use the parts of the definition that are, quote, obsolete, then you can call it obsolete, I think. But
You don't need a definition. You just need to, to say.
I mean, and okay, so, you know, what was it called? Second Life? That's obsolete.
Yeah, it's just, but
because
does
of the
that
learning
mean,
curve,
yeah,
right?
Does that mean,
but something is going to fall out of it? We're going to learn something from it. Something's going to fall out from it.
Yeah, Friendster wasn't perfect, right? Or what was the one before Friendster?
I don't even remember. But so that's the thing. You know, the same with virtual. That's why I keep talking about 3D movies. And I know there were 3D movies, you know, many many years ago and stuff. But I think the virtual reality stuff that I've all experienced was, you know, going to a special place and putting on glasses and stuff. And then it was very hard to create programs for the virtual reality stuff. And it's, you know, and it's arguable that whatever was created, like, especially like creating art for virtual reality, you know, things for apparatus. You know, I don't want to use the word obsolete and discuss whether or not it's obsolete, but it was very, very hard to do that. And on top of it, I think that if you're going to create artwork for a medium, you have to know, there has to be a lot of familiarity with the medium first in society, right? Right? I mean, like, if I'm going to create some kind of artistic experience using a VR tool, then people are going to go and then, you know, the three people who are going to get to see experience it. There's the content of and the theme of the artwork, but then there's also the fact that, ooh, I'm seeing it on this new tool. So, you know, that's part of it. So, you know, is your artwork, you know, talking about the fact that it's, you know, it's being shown, you know, mediated through this obsolete experience, or, you know, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, you're creating artwork for, you know, this special piece of machinery, or to be played on this special piece of machinery.
Well,
machinery.
Part of communication is that it's got the apparatus for communication has to be familiar to the person you're communicating with, right?
Yeah.
So the appeal, though, of virtual reality is that if so people are just naturally evolved and understand the physical world, right? They've from birth they've been trained,
right?
You know,
so when
to
they see
experience
a sculpture,
it.
It's like, oh, that looks like something different than, you know, than my car that I was.
So
just
if virtual reality
ago, this
can emulate
playground.
That experience of reality, right? Then
right.
That's where it becomes effective. But until then, you're bridging a gap.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and then you're also going to be, you know, it's either you're going to be making artwork that, you know, just accentuates the bells and whistles of the medium, or, you know, or you're going to be making artwork that completely ignores it. And it's impossible to ignore, you know, that part of the experience, I think. So
yeah,
I think it's going to be very hard to, you know, although again, let me take the microphone out of my ass now and put it back to my mouth, because I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. So I told this girl that...
You know what you do is you just say the medium is the message. That's how you end it. Just like
Yeah.
So therefore, the medium
kinda,
is the message.
That's kind of what we're saying. But there's, you know, Margaret Dolinsky, who teaches in Indiana or something, is making artwork using, you know, in virtual reality and has been doing that forever. So I just told her, well, just talk to her. Why should anybody talk to me about this stuff? I hate it.
Well, you know,
and
that's
I don't
what
work in it
people
anymore.
Talk to you and then you say things and then they find other information.
Like I would never, I'm a performer and I would never record I would never record an archive and stream live my performances because snark, 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 snark,
yeah.
snark.
Well, there's just like everything, there's positives to saying things off the top of your head and they're negatives, right?
So. I really truly believe it though, you know? I mean, I wouldn't
No, you wouldn't say it if you didn't believe it. All right.
Well, let's have a Rick topic now, more well thought out.
No, that was fine. That was a little too Rick-like, actually, your whole thing there. I was hoping for a little break from the
You want me to talk about Capoeira?
The rant. No, I don't want you to Should we talk about Davy Jones? I can't believe we forgot to talk about Davy Jones last episode. You were like...
I have absolutely nothing to say about Davy Jones.
All right, then. We'll just go on.
No, you can...
We'll talk about
Capoeira. No. Go ahead. Talk about Davy Jones.
No, I just felt bad.
Oh, he's so cute.
I felt bad.
Did he die before we did Radio Zero?
Yeah, he died like the day before, so it would have been very timely if we had talked about it.
Did somebody else die, though, too?
I think so.
Who?
I don't know.
Ugh. Are you saying that or?
Yeah, no, I don't know. I was kind of joking.
A bunch of other people died.
They did.
Musicians and stuff.
Oh, musicians. I don't know. I was just thinking, you know, I like the Monkees. You know, I never had a problem with the Monkees, but I also realized, I mean, I.
You know, they weren't a real band.
They weren't a real band, exactly. Well, that was one interesting.
Just
that's
like
actually
the Sex Pistols.
A memorable moment. Yeah, I remember hearing Davy Jones interviewed on. I think it was Stephen Gary on WLS in the early 80s. And he was a very bitter man. And he was screaming about like the Turtles. He was like, Davy Jones was saying like, yeah, they call us a manufactured band, but like the Turtles didn't write any of their hit songs, you know, and going on about that. And he was right. You know, Davy Jones was right. It was a transitional period where half the bands, you know, wrote their songs and half the bands still performed. Other people, you know, songwriters wrote the music, musicians performed it, right? It was two separate roles. And so Davy Jones was particularly bitter about that idea that they weren't real in some respect.
Yeah. I feel, you know, William Shatner was on something too, wasn't he? He was just on
Colbert, I think.
Colbert, yeah. And it was freaking me out. But these people who like do something and get really famous for it and it's not what they wanted to be famous for just make me so sad, you know, because, you know, they're like, you know, oh, God damn it. If another person comes up to me and gives me the Spock, you know, finger or whatever, I'm going to be so I can't even go outside. You know, this is not what I wanted to be. I didn't want to be known for being, you know, the captain of the Starship Enterprise. I was a Shakespearean actor. So it was nice to hear him say that, you know, when Patrick Stewart was like, oh, I love being Jean-Luc Godard or whatever Picard, you know, he was like, oh, I love that. And Shatner thought, you know, had an epiphany and thought, oh, wow, you know, maybe it's not so bad that, you know, I'm famous for this.
That to me just kind of just is just a continuation of everything that he felt, though, is that, oh, the only point he felt legitimized for what he did was when someone who was an actual Royal Shakespeare Theater or what a company actor, you know, had the role and said it was a good role, you know, to be the captain. So it wasn't until someone that he respected, you know, returned the respect, right? So I watched that documentary that William Shatner did, the Captains, is it called? And he interviews Christopher Plummer, you know, because Christopher Plummer is one of the bad guys in one of the Star Trek movies. And again, Christopher Plummer is considered a real actor, right? Christopher Plummer is kind of in...
He was in The Sound of Music.
Right, exactly. And he's a perfect example of that, too. He hates that movie, right?
I know,
it's like now he's come to terms with it, but it took him like 40 years or something. It's also like Alec Guinness with Obi-Wan Kenobi, like making, you know, making children cry when they would come up to talk to him about Star Wars and say, do you realize how silly that movie is? You know, and they'd be, ah! You know, he wouldn't, he was, you know.
I mean, I was just thinking about them, right? I've been thinking about Star Wars for the past 2 days, you know, because I've been reading the Amazing Adventures of Luke Skywalker to our two-year-old.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, you know, that movie changed my life. I'm sorry, but it did. It totally changed my life. It gave me a way to think about things, you know. It gave me a way to think about existence. That, you know, so, you know, Alec Guinness was, you know, the Yoda, if you will, of that movie, you know. So, I mean, it changed a lot of people's lives.
Now, the thing is that you've gone from William Shatner and you've drawn away from William Shatner and brought it back to Star Wars. Okay. I can't believe it.
I know. Well, let's go back.
No, it's fine. We can talk about it. No, I just...
All I know is, you know, we do have to go to St. Louis so I can get a very view printout of myself in a transporter beam. That sounds like so cool. Yeah. I'm embracing my inner geek again, in a big way. I'm just gonna do that now. I'm gonna hug my inner geek.
Is that a geek or a nerd?
It's a geek. Yeah, I know. It's probably a nerd now. But did you want to say anything else about?
Well, just all those.
We went from Davy Jones to Alec Guinness in 5 minutes.
Yeah. So, oh yeah, but yeah, so being upset about what, yeah, it was interesting though, the Mike Nesmith interview I read, it was like Davy Jones was sort of like the professional actor. And, you know, anytime Mike Nesmith was upset about musical stuff, Davy Jones was like, it's a job, do it, you know, just do your job. And so again, it was that shift from, you know, sort of like the classic working actor, working musician, right, compared to the artist. Right. And also it helped that Mike Nesmith, you know, had $1 billion waiting in the wings for him. So he could, you know, it was like, he could say anything and do anything he wanted because at some point he would be independently wealthy. But I don't know much, you know, Davy was my least favorite monkey. But what I want to say about that show is that. I started thinking about the power of television, right? Because when I was a little kid, they showed that on Saturday mornings. That's really...
What did they show on?
The monkeys. I'm sorry, yeah.
Yeah.
And so for me, you know, in the early 70s, I knew more about the Monkees than I knew about the Beatles, right? The Beatles had broken up.
Oh, yeah, me too.
And so the Monkees were my formative kind of rock and roll.
Yeah, the Monkees
experience.
Were my Beatles.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's... And then that, to...
That's Generation X for you. The Monkees were our Beatles. That's why we grew up like this.
Right, exactly.
The Monkees were our Beatles.
Yeah. And then, when they reran them on MTV in the 80s, it was perfect, right?
Commercialism.
Yeah.
Friggin',
Not real music.
That's
But it
right.
was real music. The songs are good, you know?
Yeah, they're better than the Beatles.
But the reality is that the you know, my favorite songs are from
the movie Head.
Yeah, the Porpoise song. You know, it's like the Porpoise. I prefer the Porpoise song to Daydream Believer.
You know what? I don't believe you.
And that's another thing, actually, listening to Carole King. So she wrote that with... So she had a songwriting partnership. It was Carole King and Gary Goffin, right? And I remember hearing an interview with Carole King. I think it was on Fresh Air, and Terry Gross was asking about the Porpoise song. And Carole King, oh, that's all Gary. You know, because it's all this psychedelic imagery and everything like that. And Carole King, you know, is now known for more me generation, you know, solo songwriter stuff. But I think that was the same thing. You know, it was like, oh, she doesn't want to. She's totally distancing herself from her commercial sort of. Well, and the psychedelic, that bummed me out, too, is where. But it's entirely possible it was all Gary Goffin. So anyways, I digress. Have we been recording?
Yeah. Did you
okay,
press
yeah,
record?
I did.
Okay. Okay. So that takes. So I'll click off Davy Jones now. It takes care of him.
We've got a to-do list for the show now.
I know. We talked about virtual reality and art. Why don't you talk about our? We're using Asana.com. This Radio Zero broadcast brought to you by Asana.com. You know that we're just joking about these things, right? We actually have to pay for Asana. Oh, no, we don't.
It's free.
It's free. Yeah.
Yeah,
so this broadcast. Well, I can do like why do I have written here the year of the female recording engineer? And I have it spelled wrong, too. I'll just say really quickly, oh, it's very exciting. My students are you know, have a DIY, do-it-yourself recording studio in the basement of a record store, a wonderful record store, one of three record stores. Are there still three record stores in Uptown Normal, Illinois, which is, you know.
I can think of two, but there is
North Street Records.
Okay, yeah, I don't know North Street.
Yeah.
Or is that, what's the one with the red, white, and blue
North
front?
I think that's North Street.
Oh. Okay, I do.
And then
I don't know the name, I just know what it looks like.
Waiting Room Records, named after, you know, Ian's song, the Fugazi song, I mean. But anyway, so, you know, I was kind of lamenting, you know, there. So all the students have got like goals, you know, task lists to complete for running a record label and running a recording studio. And I was kind of bummed out because some of the female students were saying, oh, well, we're decorating, you know, some of the things on their task list that they've set out for themselves to do is to decorate the studio. And the guys are like, we're going to plug in stuff, you know. So I was like, oh man, it's starting to look like the girls are, you know, doing the decorating and the guys are plugging stuff in. And it kind of, you know, I got a little bummed out because that's like the stereotype, you know. And even though we do know like what one female engineer, Liz, right?
Yeah, and there, I remember.
Is there another one somewhere?
Yeah,
in the world?
I can't remember her name. She worked at, she stayed at our house once. She was doing live sound for a band. I can't remember her name, and she worked at The Empty Bottle.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Who was that? But everybody else, everybody else are males. So, I mean, I was thinking, and I mean, when I'm standing around a sound. One of them things called
what
mixing board.
What is it called, that thing with all the buttons?
Yeah. No, seriously. I don't feel like, I mean, I don't feel like driving it. It's weird. I remember.
Well, it's interesting because you've been doing the streaming stuff and you've had to work in the control room,
yeah,
and everything
I don't mind.
Like that.
Yeah, so I'm getting more at home in that. I was thinking I'm getting more at home in the sound booth now. You know, and really what it could use is a stove and a refrigerator. It's got a refrigerator. And I was thinking, I feel a little bit more at home now. And I mean, I'm looking at the soundboard and I'm thinking, you know, and when people are talking, you know, you were talking, you know, I made you come in there and you know, look at the manual like I'm some kind of fucking
the
moron.
The manual.
Yeah, right. Exactly. They don't call it a woman mule for nothing. Right. But I'm like, I'm, you know, and you're talking about whatever, auxiliary sends and stuff. And I'm like, well, I remember you telling me all about that stuff. I remember being told about this stuff over and over and over again. It's like, I know all this stuff. And if every man in the world was, you know, gone, like went off to the whatever planet we're going to colonize, or if you all went back into the time portal of, what TV show is that?
Terra Nova.
Terra Nova. If you all went to Terra Nova, I could probably engineer something. I really could, you know, but for some reason I don't know. So I don't know what it is about. I don't know what it is about women and buttons, but.
But okay. So this is the thing though, is we had this discussion about, the computer programming and the math stuff, right? With you.
Yeah.
An episode or two ago,
right.
Where you had no problem with that stuff, and it was because
the
audio.
Yeah.
You know, part of it is that, you know, the secret of engineering is to pretend you know what you're doing or to project that. Whereas, and so I think men don't view that as lying.
Yeah,
right. Women, they view that as it's a status thing. You're
right.
It's kind of a cultural thing that men need to know to look like they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Whereas culturally, women, you know, are often more collaborative and are willing to say, oh, I don't know what I'm doing
more
right
honest.
Now. More honest,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and so
it's not a problem culturally for women to not know what they're doing. In fact,
right.
In some parts of this country, it's not frowned upon, but it's encouraged.
Expected. Encouraged, right. Yes.
For you
so,
to be an idiot.
And so, I mean, and the thing is that it is not rocket science, right?
No,
audio,
it really isn't.
I mean,
it occurred to me that it's not. It can't be.
All it is a specialized interface that's, you know, even for me is confusing, you know, when I look at it. But
well,
I just kind of improv, you know, and figure out how to get it to work.
Yeah, that's what I've learned now. You know, every man I'm surrounded by at my job knows their way around a mixing board. Or like, I feel like you guys, you know, I could just ask any of these guys and they'll know. But all you guys, when you come in and you look, well, I'd have to read the manual. I'm going to have to look and see. So I realize that it's just it is just an interface that has many different options, and you actually have to read the manual in order to figure out how the thing is wired. And I didn't know. I just thought it was inherent. I thought with your penis came the manual, you know, implanted in your DNA.
Well, no. I mean, I did look at the back, and I was like, oh, yeah, okay, it's got this. And then I had to look in the manual, figure out what the tape outs were wired to,
right? Yeah, but I could do
that.
Right, exactly. And I was, when you were doing that, I was thinking, well, I could do that. Why couldn't I do that? You know, but I don't feel,
But the other thing is just experience. I mean, I've been through this nightmare process a lot, you know, whereas you haven't. So it's also just wanting to spend the time, because there are plenty of... Yeah. Plenty of men who have no interest in learning how to make a mixer work, right? You know, it's not, so you have to be interested in and want to understand it.
Yeah,
you know?
But I'm really interested in why I know I'm going to have a group of 11 or 12 women, men and women, standing in a recording studio in a couple of weeks, and I know who is going to feel comfortable plugging stuff in and who is going to feel like, well, why don't we let them plug things in? You know, it's going to be the girls are going to be thinking, well, why don't we let the guys plug stuff in?
But you could argue that, well, if that's the case, though, what are the roles that the women in the room could perform better than the men? You know, it's like, oh, let the boys plug in a bunch of stuff and let the girls actually, you know, make the creative decisions, or, you know, talk to the artist and figure out what they want to eat for dinner.
I know how to realize
what they want to do.
Communication is maybe an easier thing for women to do. But anyway, yeah, I just thought it was interesting because, you know, I was sitting there like kind of frowning, but I know the reality of the situation, but you were like, oh, that really bums me out. And, you know, I remember my friend Amy in Champaign was building an interface, like a musical interface for girls, you know, to tinker with, you know, and trying to figure out how to get, you know, just and we talk about trying to get more women in the computer programming courses and stuff, and in arts tech in general. So,
and you know, honestly, it's a variation on, you know, nerd geek culture. I mean, it is, or like guys who are into cars and stuff like that. You know, there's certain aspects of that are, you know, it's not, it's, well, this is the problem I have is like, you know, when you see like people talking about, I just bought a $10,000 microphone, or I bought a $10,000 mic pre, and it's the most amazing thing ever. Right. And it's like, of course you're going to say that because you just freaking blew $10,000 on it, whether or not it's actually good at what you want and actually sounds good is totally polluted by all that kind of weird status stuff and everything like that.
But that's the same with buying jeans too.
Right, exactly.
You know, like,
but
you know,
I think it helps to realize that it's
pair of jeans.
It's kind of a lot of superficiality in the guise of technical knowledge, right?
That's interesting.
Because the reality is that, you know, if you're doing sound engineering, mixing, things like that, it's good if you have a basic knowledge of physics and all those kind of things, right? But the reality is you're not a physicist. You know, it's like, oh, there's a certain level of intelligence there, but it's not rocket science. So, but I mean, if you're building the equipment, right, you're designing the equipment, that's a completely different level than if you're just using it, right? But it allows you to seem, you know, kind of on that higher level. And that happens a lot with, you know, this is the argument between like programming and actual computer science, right? You know, it's like, well, programming is not computer science. Computer science is math. You know, there's a lot more going on, and it's like,
yeah.
And so that was, you know, at some point I realized that it's like, oh, I'm not really interested in computer science. I'm interested in programming, which is not really that. It's not.
Yeah, it's more the,
it's not research level.
Than, right. It's more
scientific pursuits. It's more problem solving.
Application-based.
Yeah, application-based. And that's the same thing with audio engineering. It's like it has this. This kind of culture of I'm doing something really impressive, but the reality is that you're not really doing anything that's, you know, on the level of a rocket scientist, right? a scientific researcher. You know?
Okay. All right. Well. All right. I'm going to check that off. I didn't even want to spend that much time on it, but you know, I do want to. I just want to get more, feel even more and more at home with that. But it is interesting. Yeah, you know, I'm perfectly happy streaming stuff because there's software involved that I can tinker with. And, you know, and it's, I was thinking, well, this is about the same thing as playing with the, you know, the big scary soundboard. So why don't I just, you know, learn more about that? So anyway, thanks for helping me with whatever you did help me with, you know.
No problem, little lady.
Yeah.
Let me know anytime you need some help with this.
Okay, so last on the list here is Pink Slime. You know, I listened to Rachel Maddow because I can't figure out how to download on the media, you know, when I'm coming back from Champagne's, and she's right there on my Stitcher radio. This portion of the show brought to you by Stitcher radio, which is the most friggin' irritating thing. And I don't watch Rachel Maddow because I don't know when it's on.
And we don't have cable.
Yeah, we don't have cable, and you know, whatever.
Is it available on the internet?
I'm sure it is, but I don't watch it. But I listen to her.
Some of the shows aren't.
Yeah. Oh, really? Oh, maybe it's, no, it probably is. But I listened to her, and she always, there's this weird noise, ching, like before, it sounds like a tape starting or something before she rolls a tape. And I mean, I've been listening to it for a while, and I realized she keeps talking about seeing things, and I realized, oh, she has an actual visual TV show, right? Yeah.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So you're just listening to the audio.
I'm only
the
listening
audio.
To it. Yeah, to the okay, audio because I'm it. Driving. Yeah. So I'm just like, what is that noise? So we need that noise. We need like, just like a, it sounds like this. That's what it sounds like. Here, I'll
like
do it.
Like a page turn?
Yeah.
All right.
And then you hear Rush Limbaugh talk and say,
I see.
Call that woman a slut. So Pink Slime.
Well, apparently it's not just in fast food hamburger. It's in the
wait a minute.
The hamburger you buy at the store.
Did we talk about Rush Limbaugh calling that poor woman a slut?
No, we didn't.
No,
because
no,
that
I yelled
happened.
About it the next day.
Yeah, you yelled about it after.
I got so mad.
After an episode.
Right, but anyway, back to the pink slime. Rush Limbaugh.
The Go pink on. Slime, also yeah. known as Rush Limbaugh. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if there's much to talk about, but it's again disappointing that, you know, the supposedly real meat that you get at the grocery store is just as manufactured as the bad meat you get at the fast food restaurant. So apparently they've been taking the trimmings, the leftovers that in the past would never be fit for human consumption. Somebody figured out 30 years ago that you could grind it up into a paste, treat it with ammonia, and stick it back into the meat and fill out the meat with all the trimmings in a sanitary way without poisoning people directly. I did my air quotes for poisoning.
You know what? Also, if you haven't seen Food Inc., you can actually find it. It's like on Hulu, right? You said this is a great, great movie. But I think I'm pretty sure that you get to actually see the pink slime, the filler.
I think they have the chicken nuggets slime. I think that and yeah, the beef. And so yeah, it's I guess it's just a little. I mean, it's obvious, I guess, that it would be. You know, if they're going to do that for McDonald's, why wouldn't they do that for everybody else? Why wouldn't you be paying for that same kind of odd meat product? I guess the problem is that it's not a direct thing. Like the impression you get when you grab that weird snaky. I never really liked those packages of beef, you know, or ground beef. They always kind of freaked me out. But that it's not directly coming from the cow. A chunk of the cow goes into the grinder and comes out. There's a chunk of the cow goes in the grinder, and then other parts of the cow go into the grinder, get treated with ammonia, and then gets
so
fed
like cow
back
noses
into.
And stuff. Like,
oh
why
yeah,
are just, they, is that just because it's too hard to separate the noses after they kill them?
No, they separate it all out and they treat this other stuff, the trimmings. It was just not considered fit for human consumption because of hygienic reasons, I believe, and quality reasons, and
in.
they can. You know, pulverize it to the point where it, and then if you mix it in with the traditional kind of ground beef, it actually kind of acts as a bonding agent too.
But it has to be
washed. It looks
like
meat. When you cook it, it has to be sanitized
with ammonia. So do they wash the ammonia off afterwards? I mean, is this, you know, is this really something that we need to worry about or, you know, I mean.
No, we don't need to worry about it at all because we don't eat ground beef. So.
Well, there you go. But those of you who do eat ground beef, I guess that would you're eating something that's been washed in ammonia. But I mean, that'll make it very clean.
Yeah, right? I mean,
what
it's
if it
similar.
Wasn't washed in ammonia? What if it? Remember when we were in Nepal? Remember we were like, you'd walk around and you'd see like, like every night we'd eat like a $2 steak because I think we were eating meat back then.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Like $2 or $3, you know. And but then during the day you'd walk around and there's just like slabs of meat just hanging out, you know, people selling slabs of meat and there's flies everywhere all over them and stuff.
Uh-huh.
Mm.
And when I went to Indonesia, what was it, like 20 years ago? They didn't have any McDonald's there at the time because they could not get quality. Like the beef, even there, was not high quality enough. Plenty of Kentucky Fried Chickens at the time, but no McDonald's. You'd have to go to Singapore to get a McDonald's hamburger because I guess it was too expensive to ship stuff to from Australia. I think it was all coming from Australia, the beef, and it was too expensive to support that in Indonesia. Now I think they probably have McDonald's. But it's this, yeah. What were we talking about?
Pink slime.
All right. I don't know. I feel like everybody who needs to know about that knows about it.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to check it off then. But I have to wait for like 5 minutes for my friggin' computer to take so long.
But the thing I would advise is if you are going to eat meat that...
You killed yourself.
Either you killed yourself or that you can actually see it still looks kind of like meat. Hasn't been processed in any way, even just ground up, right? Or you know that somebody made the sausage in their barn, right? You have like a video online of this guy, you know, grinding up the sausage and
this is like the guy. This is a Portlandia episode, right? Right?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Can I just ask, was the chicken happy or whatever?
Yeah. That same kind of thing. And so the thing is, you don't need as much protein as you think you need. So if you're used to eating, like it's like, well, I have to eat a hamburger every day. You know, it's like, well, you know what? No. Spend that money that you spent on a hamburger. Buy...
Cigarettes.
buy a nice cut of beef, right? Eat that once a week and then supplement your diet with non...
Vegetables.
Yeah, vegetables and everything
beans.
Like that. Yeah. And then you're going to be healthy. You're not going to be eating weird meat. You're going to be eating regular meat and you're going to keep your money. You know, you're going to have the same budget for your food. So... Don't change your food budget. Just improve the meat and then supplement, you know, take meat vacations, I guess, and improve the quality. A meatcation, yes. And improve the quality of what you're consuming.
That's the title of this podcast, Meatcation.
Meatcation.
That's great.
I was looking for a title.
I just have to put a plug in for this book, this portion of Radio Zero, brought to you by Forks Over Knives. And I haven't even seen, we have to watch it, right? We have to watch the documentary. But
it's vegan propaganda, Rose.
Oh, good. Hold on, I had to itch my nose. I made these great cookies and the kids are eating them and they're like no-bake cookies. Did I talk about that last week?
I probably did.
It's like cocoa and like maple syrup and almond milk and oatmeal. Did I say oatmeal already? Oats. And peanut butter and vanilla. That's it. And you like mix that all together in this Forks Over Knives book, the recipes in this Forks Over Knives book. So you can probably find it online. But there's like no overt sugar in it really at all. And you don't even have to bake them. And our kids are just eating them like crazy. And they're like totally chocolatey too. But I made them with dark chocolate cocoa. And there's not even any sugar in that. It's like the only sugar that's coming from this is maple syrup sugar. And I don't even have maple syrup. I'm using sorghum because I bought that instead for $7. It was very expensive. But it's lasting a while. But I mean, that's so exciting. And then this bean recipe that I had, the black bean recipe, called for a cut up red pepper and water chestnuts. And, you know, you were like, water chestnuts, but they were really good, weren't they?
Oh, yeah, no, it was just a strange thing to have in there.
It's just strange to have a cut-up red pepper that I didn't fry in, you know, olive oil.
That to me makes sense. It's just,
yeah.
So red pepper,
yeah,
black beans, but then water chestnuts to me don't make sense.
Yeah,
but they were fine.
They were.
you know, it's an interesting, it's crunchy and they don't really taste like much.
No, they don't. They taste like the black beans. And then like,
but it's hard to get kids to eat water chestnuts. I know that from experience as a child.
Yeah. Well, I don't, you know, well, it was kind of cool that one of our kids actually ate the black beans though. And I mean, and I drained them and it's like, I think there's like Bragg's involved. There's a little bit of Bragg's involved in it. And I can't remember what else, broth, you know, vegetable broth. But they seem really healthy and they seem a little bit more raw. Like, you know, it's raw red pepper. It hasn't been cooked already, so it's better for you. Mm-hmm. You know, it's I don't know, it's cool. I'm so excited to find new recipes, you know. And then to just like with the dinners, like serve, you know, some kind of a fruit too with the dinner, like as another course, just raw fruit. That's mm-hmm. good.
Yeah.
So meatcation.
See, the thing is, our last episode was called Meat Mother.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, you know, it could be a meat month, the month of meat.
It's what's for dinner.
Yeah, yeah. March is meat month. All right. You have anything else?
We're at like 55 minutes.
Okay. Five minutes to spare. Have you watched any good movies?
No, I did watch the Dr. Bronner soap.
I'm so jealous that you watched that.
It was okay. It was pretty good. It was interesting.
Yeah, I want to watch it. But
does
a small child get killed in it?
No, but I mean, he did abandon his family for a long period of time in order to save Spaceship Earth.
Well, so did Buddha.
Exactly. I mean, that's the thing.
Did he leave when he was 27?
One of his sons is kind of the predominant focus of the documentary, or Dr. Bronner is kind of viewed, because his son, you know, I don't know if he's still alive, but when this documentary was made, was, you know, kind of represented the company, would go around talking about it, do like a spoken word kind of performance talking about his father's life and experiences. And so it's, what was I going to say?
About Dr. Bronner.
It was interesting. It was not the greatest documentary, but it was pretty good. I mean, he talked about a lot more than soap. Let's just say he's an interesting guy.
The Dr. Bronner's, I mean, just, you know, you see the, what is that called when somebody writes too much? The hypergraphia, yeah. All over the soap bottles, you know, lends you to believe that there's more of a story there than just soap.
Oh, right.
Soap.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that that's on the package, it's like, wow, you're really advertising this, you know.
So what happened was, he had been hospitalized because he's a little too animated when he would talk about stuff, and then once he escaped the mental hospital in Elgin, Illinois, actually, and then went to California and started his soap company, he came from a family of soap manufacturers from Germany, but left, you know, before the Holocaust.
There's footage of him.
Oh yeah. There's lots of film of him. In fact, there's a really funny thing, like a woman talking about him, and he's in the background talking at the same time, like from the 70s, and he's sitting at the edge of a pool, and they're interviewing another woman about him, and he's in the background, and you know, it's so they've got the microphone on the woman, but you can just hear in the background, there's just like a constant noise in the background of him talking, ranting about, you know, saving the world and everything like that. But,
okay, at the end of this, did you still feel like it's okay to use the soap?
Oh yeah. Oh no. Okay, the company is very progressive.
Good.
You know, about equity. Like, I think they said the owners only get paid five times what the lowest paid member of their company gets paid. So
why
equity?
Is that? No, I'm just kidding.
No. But it's equity. They give away a huge amount of money to charity. So, and it's still a family business. They, at least at the time of the documentary, I don't know if things have changed. It's like 5 or 6 years old. So, it, you know, similar to that kind of Ben and Jerry's, although I'm not sure what's going on with Ben and Jerry's now, but you know, back in the, you know, whatever it was 20 or 30 years ago, that was the example of like a conscientious company. And it's that same kind of model where in fact, the son was walking around talking to people and saying like, my employees, this year got $10,000 bonuses, you know, when our company does good, everybody got it, you know.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah. And it was like, you know, talking about capitalism in a very kind of aggressive, progressive way that you don't even hear, you know, you know, people who call themselves progressive talking that way. You know, it's like you can run a company that, you know, helps people, helps their employees, you know, and still be successful. And it was really interesting to hear somebody who, yeah, owns a company talking like a progressive. And on top of it, Dr. Bronner was a rabid anti-communist too. So it doesn't fit any of these equations. So it's, you know, family business, ground up, you know, built by hand, you know, and then socially responsible, and also, you know, founded by a rabid anti-communist, you know.
Wow. I mean, we have, you know, a couple of different containers for Dr. Bronner's soap. You know, they're not huge or anything. And I just take them back to the store and refill them all the time, too. I really love that. This summer I'm going to focus on not getting so much packaging, you know, because, I mean, every time we go and buy noodles, too, I mean, I think there's a place to get noodles around here even, you know, where I just stick them in the bag instead of putting, you know, buying a box full of them.
Bulk,
right.
Yeah.
All right. Good. And, you know, I don't want to start this, but you also watched the Shut Up Little Man
I did watch the Shut Up Little Man documentary.
That made me so happy. Yeah. I just...
Yeah. It was... Reminded had a lot me. To say about, viral media and copyright. Like, everything that we deal with now. I mean, the Shut Up Little Man... the other documentary, the Winnebago Man documentary, is also, you know, similar. We're talking about viral... So Winnebago Man was, you know, VHS viral, and then Shut Up Little Man was cassette tapes, and it's all kind of precursor to what's going on now with the web and viral video. But
very
those things would happen, yeah, over the course of 10 years. But then also the stuff about copywriting it and paying the guys, all that kind of stuff
just
is amazing.
Just thinking about whether or not, you know, it's morally, you know.
Yeah. Like, was this art even, or is this just, you're just stealing someone's life and now you're copywriting it and selling it?
So reality TV too.
Yeah. You know, and then just
sort of reality shows.
Yeah. That's really interesting.
Exploitation.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of different things in there, but it also reminded me of, you know, however many years ago that it came out, you know, and being part of that, you know, hearing it. I think we were in San Francisco and somebody played it for us. We were on tour. And so that's another, like, small nugget of culture that belongs to Generation X, our generation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I always get really excited when I'm reminded of things that belong to our generation. It's just like you were talking about the Jim Jarmusch movie earlier, and you know, the 25th, you know, anniversary of Touch and Go Records, May It Rest in Peace, you know, like seeing the Digits perform and stuff. It's like, oh yeah, that was who I was when I was, you know, when I was feeling like I was something, you know, and I don't feel like I don't feel like I'm creating culture anymore or like I'm in it anymore.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You're a grup.
Yeah. I feel like a grup. Why? How did that happen? And do we have to be like nuts, crazy, insane in mental institutions to actually still be creating and not be grups anymore? How do we become vibrant and, you know...
It's just different. If you're
just
a teacher,
because we have kids. Yeah,
if
I'm
you're
a teacher, right.
Yeah,
we should be able to be doing that. We should start a podcast.
Well, no, but what I'm saying is that's your role now. Your role is not
right. Is to let others.
You're a mentor now.
Yeah.
You're transitioning to mentorship rather than being on the front lines.
But so it is nice when we see our stuff that we've created, and I don't mean like I created it, but I mean the
generational
stuff, right?
Evidence of some kind of
statement,
right?
Made by
sandwiched between, you know,
the boomers and
those boomers and those
friggin' those hippies and the
millennial kids.
All right.
Oh, I gotta play some music.
You
I
play
forgot.
Some digits.
No, I'm gonna play another
No Wave song. Good.
No Wave song. Let's see.
Thank you for listening, everybody.
No, actually, this isn't No Wave either. It's just another Wharton Tears associated song.